America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is The Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And is this the greatest crisis ever for this great nation? Wasn't Joe Biden supposed to come in and soothe things and move things in the right direction? Is this just a crisis of leadership, a crisis for Democratic agendas, and a crisis for the liberals who run the Congress and the White House right now? Or is it an existential crisis for the whole country? 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number, and be glad to take your calls and your comments. There was a remarkable statement made by documentarian Ken Burns, who has done such a good job, and basically all his documentaries, his tellings of American history have been quite spectacular, using together various voices, direct recollections, and photographs mostly, though for some of the more recent documentaries it includes not just still photographs, but footage, film footage. In any event, he has a new documentary coming out about Muhammad Ali, which should be interesting. But he was out promoting that, and I hope he'll come promote it on our show. Love to speak to him. He is out promoting that on a podcast called Smart Less, hosted by Will Arnett, Jason Bateman, and Sean Hayes of MSNBC. And he actually went so far as to say that this is one of the most dire crises, one of the most grim moments, one of the most threatening situations in which this great nation has ever found itself. Listen.
It's really serious. There are three great crises before this: the Civil War, the Depression, and World War II. This is equal to it. And it's the first time that we've got... Lincoln gave this great talk when he was very, very young to the Young Men's Lyceum on a Saturday afternoon, I think it was. People will write in and tell you that that wasn't a Saturday afternoon. It was an afternoon conversation about foreign policy. He said, this is when he's like not even 29, he's a lawyer in Springfield. He said, "Whence shall we expect the approach of danger? Shall some transatlantic giant step the earth and crush us at a blow?" And then he answered his own question. "Never. All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa could not by force take a drink from the Ohio River or make a track in the Blue Ridge in the trial of 1,000 years. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we will live through all time or die by suicide." And we're looking right down the muzzle of that gun.
He's talking about a suicidal gun. It does feel like that, doesn't it, sometimes? But I do think it's important to put it in perspective. Because when you're comparing this to the Civil War, that's an existential crisis. If things go a little bit differently in a couple of battles, even just one battle, the Battle of Antietam, if the Battle of Antietam isn't won by the Union, and it was even considered largely a draw, not even a clear Union victory, but it was at least that draw that allowed Lincoln to then issue the Emancipation Proclamation. This is all a story that's told in American Miracle, my book, and which is available through michaelmedved.com. The Civil War, if it goes bad and America breaks up, as many, many historians have pointed out, it wouldn't be just the division of the United States into two countries, the Confederate States of America and the United States of America. It almost surely there are other Confederate states and perhaps even some other Union states which would go their own way and also become something of a separate country. I mean, Texas even had a background that way. Texas between 1837 and 1848 was an independent nation, basically, with a president. Sam Houston was the first president of Texas. And That would have been a different country, and the entire notion of one nation indivisible, of one continent united, would not have been there. And plus, there would have been, of course, additional burdens of racism and slavery and oppression that would have continued and continue to bring division among the American people. So I think comparing anything to the Civil War is just not accurate and right. And the Depression is a different kind of crisis that lasted over a very long time, and partially because I think that Franklin Roosevelt applied some of the wrong remedies to the economic downturn that made that economic downturn worse and longer. And don't forget, the Depression lasted about a decade before we even began to get back to economic vitality and the opportunity for people to have jobs. You know that at that time, when families in America, for the most part, the overwhelming majority of families had just one wage earner. It was not husband and wife both working. It was usually the guy working. And we got up to over 25% unemployment. Can you imagine? This is all deeply problematic. And to say that what we're going through right now compares to that, if you just look at the way that income has gone and unemployment has gone, we are still better off, even with the setbacks of COVID, in terms of median income nationally and in terms of unemployment nationally. We're better off than we were during the Great Recession. We still have a net increase. We're actually still higher than we were in terms of people finding work than we were in the Obama administration, which wasn't so long ago. And yet, right now, the Real Clear Politics, what they find in their most recent numbers from September 16th, 31% of Americans think we're going in the right direction. 62% think we're going in the wrong direction. That's incredibly bad, and it's changed very quickly. I think largely influenced by the Afghanistan debacle. Bob in Marysville, Washington. Bob, you're on the Michael Medved Show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to talk to you. One of the things I mentioned was that when Reagan was president and George W. Bush was president and Trump, we all seem to have more than once some self-proclaimed expert psychologist saying that these people were mentally unfit to be president. And Reagan, they were saying he was too old and he had Alzheimer's, and Bush, they just thought he had some kind of brain issues, and Trump similarly. But we don't hear this kind of criticism about Biden, and he surely seems,
you haven't been listening.
About his punctuality. I think some of that is they're waiting for a brain fog to clear up in the man.
Okay, if you don't think that there have been people who have been raising questions about President Biden's cognitive ability, including the former president. And by the way, Barack Obama, who was a brilliant guy, and he has nothing wrong with his mind at all. He's smart. But he was also chronically late. It was one of the most frustrating things covering the Obama administration or Obama events. That I don't know what it is. Republicans are much more likely to show up on time. President Trump wasn't always great with that. But I don't think it's fair to say that President Biden, being the oldest president we've ever had, has been free of questions about his cognitive ability. Coming up, Chris Christie and more on The Medved Show. On The Michael Medved Show, one thing you can do that's on the cheerful side try Balance 7. It's the dietary supplement and alkalizer concentrate that gives you 7 benefits, hence Balance 7. Balance 7 pH concentrate for these 7 benefits: mental energy, more of it, mental clarity, more of it, relief from joint discomfort, boost for your immunity system, optimizing for a pH balance, help with weight loss while detoxing your body. It also relieves heartburn and aids in your digestion. And right now, if you go to balance7.com and use the code AL, A-L, that's the name of the founder, at checkout, you receive a free 4-ounce bottle of My Smooth Skin with any purchase of Balance 7 products. My Smooth Skin retails at $13.99, but it's free, completely free, with your Balance 7 dietary supplement order. Again, head to balance7.com, use the code word AL at checkout, and get in on the free bottle of My Smooth Skin in this promotion for Balance 7 pH concentrate. Okay, let us go quickly talking about Ken Burns suggesting that America is on the verge of suicide. He says, looking down the barrel of a gun. Will in Sarasota, Florida. Hello, Will.
Hi, Michael. Yeah, the Ken Burns comment about us looking at down the barrel of a suicide gun, I think, is pretty relevant today. Because when someone is facing an identity crisis, they could commit suicide. And I think this country, since about the late 60s, has an identity crisis. A lot of people don't really believe in what I take for granted as Americans. I'm a very patriotic person, and I believe in the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and all the founders, what they believed in. But a lot of people don't hold that near and dear anymore, and they question a lot of the institutions that made this country great.
I hate to say this, but I think that a lot of those people, I think you're right that a lot of people don't hold the values of this country, the history of this country, as dearly as they should. But it's not because they reject us, because they don't know it.
Well, I
mean,
agree with
the ignorance that Americans have about our own history. If people were asked about those other great crises that Ken Burns talks about, the Depression and World War II and the Civil War, most people don't know who we were fighting in World War II. They can't name the countries we were fighting. Do you know that?
Yeah.
I mean, which is just unbelievable, especially when kind of everybody's grandfather actually had some direct experience with that war. We had 16 million men, mostly men, who fought in World War II. But I think your idea of an identity crisis, what do you think the core of that conflict is in terms of the way people perceive what America is?
I think a lot of that is the public school system has done a very poor job in the university system, and the humanities have not reinforced American values. And then also I think a lot of our leadership and just the federal government. I'm a limited government person. The federal government is just far too big. We have too big of an administrative state that affects our lives, even though we have a lot of freedom in this country. But when the government gets too big, it politicizes everything, and then that's where the disagreements come, because everyone's fighting over where taxes should go and who should be taxed and who gets this benefit and whatnot. And so it creates dissension and dissatisfaction in the public.
Well, what's fascinating, Will, is I think you're right in basically everything that you're saying, except there's an inherent contradiction in it. Because, yes, government is too big, and, yes, government meddles in all kinds of instances where it shouldn't. But at the same time, government does an incredibly poor job in teaching people about the country and teaching people about those founding documents that you mentioned, or the heroic story that really has inspired the whole world since before we won the revolution. The other thing is, when you talk about since the late 60s, I've written about this considerably, and I've written about it in my most recent book, God's Hand on America. For people who think that America fell apart in the 60s, there were terrible things in the 60s, an emphasis on drugs, an undermining of the family, an undermining of patriotism, the idea that somehow causing chaos on the streets was the essence of loving liberty. It's not. With all of that and all of everything that's wrong, we've had a pretty good innings since the 60s. We've won the Cold War. That's a very big deal. We have made real progress on racial justice issues. Those issues were enormously advanced between 1960 and 1990, say. And then again, we've completely changed the world with the base communications device, the internet, and the just the access to knowledge. And with all of the shortcomings we have in our university systems, the idea that we once had in 1965, about 5% of American adults were four-year college graduates. Now it's over 40%. And, yeah, that doesn't mean you're well-educated, but at least there's something of a chance. I just would, I think anyone who is proclaiming the end is near hasn't paid attention to the history of American resiliency. Will, I appreciate the call, and stay safe and warm. Well, you'll stay warm because you're in Sarasota, Florida. And appreciate the call very much. Call again. Coming up, Chris Christie. He has written a book called Republican Rescue, Saving the Party from Truth Deniers, Conspiracy Theorists, and the Dangerous Policies of Joe Biden. It's in hardcover. It's coming out in November of 2021. So it'll be not in time for the election of 2021 in Virginia or in New Jersey, but well in time for the election of 2022 and 2024. What does Chris Christie have to say about how we handle making real progress on COVID, progress that people can feel with their kids? There's news today that Pfizer is saying that they now believe that the vaccines are going to work for children as young as five. How do you actually get those vaccines to people? And what should the response be for Republican rescue in terms of dealing with the controversial mandates that Joe Biden has advanced? We'll be speaking with Governor Chris Christie, coming right up on the Medved Show.
He knows who he is and he knows what he believes.
Michael Medved.
Michael Medved Show, you might ask a question. Why would anyone care about Republican rescue unless you were already a committed Republican? Well, partially because without the Republican Party flying right, straight, getting up off the mat, putting itself back together, healing some divisions, we've got basically a one-party system, and that's never good. Chris Christie has written a book called Republican Rescue. It's coming out in a couple of weeks. It's not available yet, but it has a great cover. It shows a pachyderm, an elephant, holding a life preserver in its trunk. Governor Christie, always great to speak with you, and congratulations. Can't wait to see the new book.
Michael, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to it coming out, too.
I'm sure you are. Tell me about this. You've been governor of a state very successfully for two terms. And if you were still governor of New Jersey, would you be working with Joe Biden and the Democratic administration to help to put a vaccination mandate in place in New Jersey?
No, I don't think there should be vaccine mandates, Michael. I think that I've always thought as conservative that the right way to go is to have the form of government that's closest to the people make these decisions on what should be happening in each community. And so I think it's wrong for the for the president to be doing this. And I think it's bad for the country for him to be doing it for this reason. I speak as someone who's been vaccinated, all the members of my family vaccinated, and I've urged people publicly and urged them now to go and get the vaccine. It's the best way to protect you and those around you. But there is division in this country over this. And when you do have the government play a very heavy hand, I'm fearful that he'll harden positions even more and make people even less likely to get vaccinated who haven't been vaccinated yet. We need to persuade people with facts. There are plenty of facts out there to persuade people with, and we need to be persistent and continuing to do that.
Okay, let me ask you what I think is a difficult question, which is, with that principle in mind that you've articulated so well, what do you say about all of the vaccine mandates that exist in all 50 states, every single one of them? Mississippi has some of the toughest mandates in the country, where they require vaccines for children to attend public schools. Do you think those should be stripped away, or do you think those serve an important public purpose?
No, I think they serve an important public purpose, and here's why I don't think the question is all that difficult. Over a period of time, those mandates have been put into place after input from, you know, citizens, from local governments, school boards, and all the rest, to where states ultimately have those mandates. And New Jersey has a number of those mandates as well in our state. We're one of the tougher states in terms of vaccine mandates. I'm not opposed to it. I don't think it should come from the federal government, Michael. That's the difference.
Well, that's why when I asked you the question, I was asking if you were governor of New Jersey, would you work with the president? I know some Democratic governors are. And do you think it's a worthwhile goal to pursue, to try to get more than the 52 or 53% who are fully vaccinated now? That's
Absolutely. Something
that the government should pursue? Yep, okay.
Absolutely. And I think state government should pursue that. Each individual state in their own way has to best persuade their people to do it. And ultimately, let's remember, we have only had one of these vaccines that's been fully approved yet by the FDA. So I think that one of the things that when you look at a vaccine mandate for, let's say, measles or rubella or whooping cough, or, you know, you go through all the ones that, you know, all my children have had and are required to have before they can enter school, polio vaccine, et cetera. All those now have gone through, you know, full FDA approval. And so I think that's part of what needs to be done here with all the vaccines. Pfizer vaccine has been fully approved. And I think the states will work through their way to persuade people to get the vaccine and then ultimately to require people to get the vaccine after all these things have been fully approved and tested out. But I don't think that it's the federal government's role to do that. And I don't think we've seen that done in the past, Michael. I don't think it's a smart thing to be doing now.
Okay, so is there a role for Joe Biden? He campaigned on trying to help reduce the impact of the pandemic, of the COVID-19 pandemic across the country and around the world. Is there any role for the federal government?
Sure. The federal government's playing a lot of important roles. First, the entire development of the vaccine was a federal project. And I think, you know, this started to get politicized, unfortunately, during a presidential campaign where you had people like Vice President Harris saying that she wouldn't get the Trump vaccine approved by the Trump FDA. I mean,
terrible thing to say.
Right, caused damage and is part of the cause, not all of it, but part of the cause of the politicization, the hesitancy now. But I think, you know, the best thing President Biden can do is to be assembling groups of experts, doctors, and people who have gone through this, had COVID, had the vaccine, not had the vaccine, and got COVID. We have a lot of those testimonials coming out now. And the best thing the president could be doing is be the persuader in chief. Not, you know, I said this on TV a couple of weeks ago. You know, there are some times when you're a leader of an executive branch of government where you have to come down with the hammer. And you got to let the sledgehammer down in order to lead your people. And I, and you know, Michael, that's something that I was not reluctant to do when I thought
that's
it was appropriate. But in this instance, what you need to do is be the persuader in chief first. And I don't think he's done enough of that. And I don't think he's assembled enough people to be out there having that message be heard all the time, especially from people who have not been vaccinated and have gotten COVID as a result, and the Delta variant in particular, and what that experience was like for them. I saw today, I think it was Chris Rock, who I read a brief story on, yeah, saying he got COVID and you don't want to mess with it. You don't want to get it. That's what people need to be hearing from people, both famous and regular folks who are not have any degree of fame, about what's happened to them. As you probably know, Michael, two of my relatives passed away from COVID before a vaccine was available. They were in their early 60s, in perfect health, no underlying conditions. And so this disease is very random and can be very deadly. And when you know both the fact that it's random and that it can be lethal, I think you need to hear that from the folks who have gone through things like that with their own family members, to try to convince people that taking this vaccine is not anywhere near the kind of risk that not taking it is.
I'm sure, Governor Christie, you've seen Matt Bai's piece today about you, which is generally very favorable. But he raises a question that I hope we will get to, which is that, again, your speech at the Reagan Library was very well received. Your book apparently charts out a new, fresh course for the Republican Party. The question I would put to you, and it may take more than we have in this segment, that's why we're going to another segment in a moment, but do you ever think back when you endorsed President Trump and you were the first of his rival candidates to drop out of the race and endorse Trump for the nomination in 2016? You ever think that that was a mistake?
No, and the reason I don't, Michael, is because I make no apologies for trying to make sure that Hillary Clinton was never going to be president of the United States. It's one of the reasons I ran in the first place, and it's the number one reason that I endorsed Donald Trump at the time, was that it was clear to me he was going to be the Republican nominee for president, that after Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, that there was nobody in that group who was going to stop him, and that we needed to make sure Hillary Clinton wasn't going to be president of the United States. And what's happening right now would have been happening 4 years ago if she had won.
And Chris Christie, his new book is called Republican Rescue. It's coming out in a couple of weeks. He is coming right back on the Michael Medved Show.
Michael Medved.
Keep going. Don't ever stop.
The Michael Medved Show.
Chris Christie, the 55th governor of New Jersey, husband and proud father of four, and an ABC News political and legal contributor right at the moment. Your book is called Republican Rescue, Chris. And do you, when a rescue is going on, it usually means there's a mortal danger. Do you believe that it is possible that within the next 5, 10, 20 years, the Republican Party would cease to exist as a major political force in the country?
I don't think cease to exist, Michael, but I think we run the risk of no longer being an effective political party. And I'll give you the historical example. The last time that the Republican Party lost the House, the Senate, and the White House, all within 2 years of each other, was 1930 to 1932 under Herbert Hoover. And after that, the Democratic Party went on to hold the White House 28 of the next 36 years, and the House of Representatives 48 of the next 52. In my view, America would not be able to survive that kind of drought of one-party rule for that period of time, given the circumstances confronting us around the world today. And so what we need to avoid is not the elimination of the Republican Party, but it no longer being an effective, winning political organization. And it's not like it's not possible. We saw it happen almost 90 years ago, and we see it happen again if we don't get back to having an attitude of serving the American people and winning elections.
So you're talking in your book, and I know you speak whenever you have a chance to speak about it, more than just shuffling personalities. I mean, today President Trump called for dumping Mitch McConnell as a leader in the Senate, which just seems to me an insanely divisive position to take when you're coming up to a crucial, crucial midterm election. But other than swapping personnel or changing a leadership style, what needs to change fundamentally about the Republican Party?
Oh, first off, to comment on what you just said, anything we engage in that is backwards-looking as opposed to forwards-looking is self-defeating. And,
Amen.
This is continuing, revenge, vendetta, grievance politics that is just doesn't serve the American people, and as a result, doesn't serve our party at all. In terms of what we need to go going forward is we need to put the spotlight on what the Democrats are doing right now and offer a very stark contrast. We need to get back to our roots, Michael, as a party of fiscal conservatism. We've lost our way in that regard. We gave into the siren song of, debt doesn't matter. It does. And we're now seeing it because we gave permission for it in the first 4 years of the Trump administration. Now the Democrats are saying, well, you have no credibility to fight this fight because you didn't fight the fight against huge deficits when you were in power yourselves. We need to get back to those roots. We need to get back to understanding that this country is exceptional and strong, not only because of the great people in America and our great Constitution, but also because of the great friendships we've made around the world. We need to go back to tending to those alliances in a way that serves America because we don't have to buy our friends like the Chinese or the Russians. We make our friends because of who we are as a people and what we stand for and the freedom and liberty we stand for. We need to be getting back to those things. Need to bring American manufacturing back home so that we're never again held hostage by China or any other power when we have a crisis like we did with COVID and we were at the mercy of the Chinese for essential elements we needed to fight the pandemic. Those are all things that we need to be getting back to, and there are others, and we cover them all in a whole third section of the book about what we need to do going forward for America.
And in terms of basically, Peggy Noonan wrote over the weekend about America losing the thread. People not able to connect with our past, not able to visualize a future. Clearly, going around the country, you've experienced, as I have, the pessimism that seems to be descending like a dark, noxious cloud over the whole mood of the country. What's the most crucial element in trying to dispel that and return to that morning in America can-do spirit that President Reagan, our greatest recent president, made popular?
Well, you just hit it. In the American system of government, there is no replacement for a strong, consistent, ethical voice as president. And we haven't had that. And the fact of the matter is we need to get to it again. Remember how dark the days were, Michael, and you and I are both old enough to remember the dark days of Jimmy Carter's presidency. And this Biden presidency has started to remind me very much of the Carter presidency. Incompetence, pessimism, anger, failure. And Ronald Reagan came in and changed all that, not only because he had a strong, consistent conservative philosophy, but also through the dint of his own personality, which was positive and optimistic, about this country and its future. And that's why I went to the Reagan Library 10 days ago, was to remind people that there was a day like that and there can be a day like that again. But we need to focus on America's future and having the type of leaders who are not just attacking each other and engaging in grievance politics, but are looking forward to trying to improve the lives of the American people by providing them with opportunity, not with a handout, Michael, but with opportunity for greatness. And that's what Reagan gave us, and that's what we achieved in the 80s under Reagan and continued into the early 90s, and it's where we have to get back to.
Reagan also had remarkable success, actually, working with Democrats. He had a Democrat-controlled House of Representatives all 8 years of his presidency. Is it possible at all to work with the other side of the aisle, with the radical tinge that the Democrats have taken on?
Well, it's not possible to work with the radical portions of the Democratic Party, but it is possible, I think, to work with Democrats. We see that with Joe Manchin. We see it with Kyrsten Sinema. We see it with the Problem Solvers Caucus in the House of Representatives. There are elements of their party out there that we can work with. And look, Michael, I had a fully Democratic legislature for all 8 years that I was governor, yet we accomplished extraordinary things together. And we did it by making sure that compromise was not seen as a dirty word, not seen as a villainous or treasonous word, but one that our founders set up our government to try to ensure would be necessary to get results. And that's what I did when I was governor. And so from that experience, and I don't think you have much tougher Democrats across the country than you have in the state of New Jersey, which is one of the bluest states in the country. And we all work together to figure out a way to work together. You need to get up close to those folks. You need to work with them and try to make things happen, because the country's interests need to come first.
Amen to all of that. And by the way, your senator from New Jersey, Senior Senator Bob Menendez, has been pretty tough on the Biden administration. Haven't you been a little bit surprised to see that?
Well, look, I think that Senator Menendez, I have been a little bit surprised, but not completely surprised. Senator Menendez, on many issues of foreign policy, is not with the way left of his party. You know, he's been
not
very tough on issues regarding Cuba. He's been very tough. Now you see him now on what they've done in Afghanistan. He was very tough on the Iranian nuclear deal and was opposed to that when the Obama-Biden administration did it. So there have been moments when my senator, despite some of the disagreements we have on other things, has done a very good job for the American public. And I think right now he's being a voice in the Democratic Party in the wilderness against what Biden did in Afghanistan and his foreign policy in general.
Amen to that. And then, by the way, Bob Menendez, also a pretty solid friend of Israel, which matters. And Chris Christie, your book's coming out. Anything else exciting project? You're going to be campaigning for Republican candidates across the country in 2022?
I am, Michael. I am the co-chair of the Executive Roundtable Program, fundraising program for the Republican Governors Association. When I left as RGA chairman, we had 33 Republican governors. We're down to 27 now. We need to get that number back up across the country. And during COVID, we saw how important the role of governors was, if we had forgotten. And I also am now co-chairing with Mike Pompeo the National Republican Redistricting Trust, to be the counterbalance to the Obama holder group that wants to sue their way to maintain a House Democratic majority. Pompeo and I are going to be out there helping Republicans across the country make sure we get fair and constitutional maps.
And remain this greatest nation on God's green earth.